You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Digital technology has made many functions of everyday life a lot easier for us. But given the vast array of technology that's at our fingertips, have you ever thought about the decisions we make using this technology? Are we making our choice, or is the technology influencing it? Algorithms and artificial intelligence are constantly nudging us in the direction it believes we want to go, from online purchases of music, books, or other merchandise, to the television and videos we watch at home, or the news and information we consume online, even the posts we see in our social media, even the people we want to meet in dating apps. This technology has also been helping humans make decisions on major life-changing decisions as well. Which candidates should get the job interview? Which criminal defendant or convict should get bail or be paroled? And much more. The important point, according to my guest today, is that these digital tools are not objective decision makers necessarily. They're prone to biases, sometimes incredible biases. Kartik Hosanagar says we need to educate ourselves on how algorithms are shaping and influencing our opinions and decision making, and what biases these devices are prone to, which can have major consequences, as we'll hear. Hosanagar is the author of A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, How Algorithms Are Shaping Our Lives and How We Can Stay in Control. It's published by Viking. He's a professor of technology and digital business, as well as a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Kartik Hosanagar, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your book begins with two stories, and I'd like to start with the second story, and it involves one of your students who, in the course of a day, gone somewhat wrong, wonders how much we're actually in charge of the decisions we make every day. And the way he came up with that is by actually making an algorithm of his decision-making of the day. So how much in charge are we of the decisions we make, or how much are we depending on technology and algorithms that are setting the rules for making decisions?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think algorithms are all around us. Most of us understand that, but not many of us realize how many decisions they make for us. Maybe beginning with that story you mentioned, this was a student of mine who, you know, after a lecture in our classroom where we talked about the role of algorithms, went back and reflected on what his typical day was like and came back to me and narrated the story. And essentially, what he told me was how an app in his phone was deciding what time he would wake up every day, because the idea was this app would be able to figure out where he's in his sleep cycle. He would keep it under his mattress and it would figure out, you know, is he tossing and turning, and wake him up supposedly at the optimal hour. And then he was talking about how he was going to be interviewing later that day with a company, and that opportunity actually came up because he reconnected with a friend, because LinkedIn's algorithms reminded him to reconnect that with that friend. And that friend, incidentally, he met her because algorithms at Tinder suggested that they're a match for each other and they should date. And so he narrated to me sort of this series of events, how, as I just mentioned, Tinder's algorithms led to him meeting his friend Samantha, and then LinkedIn's algorithms reminded him to reconnect with her, and that could perhaps lead to his job. And of course, beyond that, you know, whether it's simple things like, you know, what he's watching on Netflix or what he was going to listen on Spotify, all of that was governed by algorithms. And he narrated that story, which was the inspiration for a chapter in my book. And that chapter focuses on this idea of what I'm calling free will. And the idea essentially is how many of our decisions are made for us by algorithms. And my research shows that they're all around us. For example, on Amazon, over a third of our choices are driven by algorithms. On Netflix, over 80% of the media we consume is driven by algorithmic recommendations. They are also influencing who we date and marry. When you look at apps like Tinder and Match.com, they're at the workplace. Bankers are asked to consult algorithms before deciding which loan applications to approve. Recruiters consult algorithms before deciding which job applicants to invite for an interview. And they're also making life and death decisions for us, because doctors are asked to consult algorithms before selecting treatment options, especially as we are increasingly moving towards personalized medicine. Judges in courtrooms in the U.S. are asked to consult algorithms that compute risk scores for defendants, and they look at these risk scores before making bail, parole, or even sentencing decisions. So they're very much driving a lot of our decisions in our lives.
Now, the first story you tell in the book sort of gives us a reason to maybe pause, because it points up this ambivalence when it comes to algorithms that powers much of our contemporary life. You tell the story of two chat boxes. These are instruments that use algorithms and some AI to carry on chats automatically. One was called Xiao Ice in China, and you tell the story of a young girl who considered it in many ways a friend, somebody she could relate to that could share confidences with. And the second story is from Tay in America, and it sort of points out the ways in which algorithms can go wrong. Tell us about these two stories.
Yeah, it was a very interesting exercise for me to dig deeper into stories that I had read about in the press. As part of my research, I spoke to this girl, and 22-year-old lady, really, in China, Yuan Jin, who used to have regular daily conversations with a chatbot called Xiao Ice. Now, this was part of her daily routine. Some days she chatted with this chatbot for 10 minutes, and some days even for hours. And she was not unique in these habits. In fact, Xiao Ice, which is a chatbot which was created by Microsoft Research, had over 40 million followers on WeChat, which is the largest social network in China. And Microsoft created this chatbot. Essentially, it's an algorithm that can understand language and converse with people. And they created this chatbot in the persona of a teenage girl, and she's capable, or should I say, it is capable of engaging in fun, playful conversations with people. And, you know, it's become almost a social media sensation in China with 40 million followers, and the press reports that over a quarter of these followers have said, "I love you" to Xiao Ice.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the kind of love and affection Xiao Ice inspires.
I love the fact. I also love the fact that you said she at one point instead of it.
Indeed. And that's how, you know, Yuan, the person I spoke to, kept constantly referring to Xiao Ice. And so at some point I didn't know whether, you know, should Xiao Ice be she or it, given in some ways it's in the eye of the beholder, and the people chatting with her very much associate very human personality with Xiao Ice. But what was interesting was that given Xiao Ice's success in China, Microsoft decided to explore whether they could launch a similar chatbot in the U.S. that would, again, be in the persona of a teenage girl that could engage in fun, playful conversations. And this chatbot was called Tay. It was targeted primarily at young adults and teenagers, and Microsoft created this chatbot and released it on Twitter. Now, Tay's story was unusual and very different. Tay turned racist, sexist, fascist within an hour and said many outrageous things, such as Hitler was right or feminists must burn in hell and many other things that I probably cannot repeat here on the show. But what was also very unusual about this was that Tay just kept getting worse as the hours went by. And within 24 hours of launching Microsoft Tay, Microsoft decided to shut down the project and essentially close this project. And later that year, MIT's Technology Review rated Tay as the worst technology of 2016. And that observation led me to wonder, how is it possible that two very similar algorithms created by the exact same company have such different outcomes? You know, inspiring love and affection in China and being so full of prejudice and hate when it was launched on Twitter in the U.S. And more broadly, it kind of made me ask this question, what does that have to say about our increasing use of algorithms in so many other settings? Might algorithms be just as unpredictable in other settings as well? And might they be, again, prone to biases and prejudice in these other settings? And what's causing it, and what can we do to manage all of that?
As you began researching, you've referred to the flash crash of May 6, 2010, which the Dow dropped, I think it was 1,000 points in just a few minutes or even less than minutes. That was rectified, But then as I did some further research, there have been other flash crashes as well. There's been one against the Swiss franc in 2015. There's been a couple of others in other commodities. So algorithms can go awry sometimes.
Absolutely. Algorithms can go awry. You mentioned the flash crash. Within 34 minutes, $1 trillion of market value was wiped off, and some blue chip stocks were trading for pennies. As you mentioned, the regulator stepped in, reversed many of those trades, and eventually the market did mostly recover from it. But, you know, it kind of did raise concerns about, you know, what could go wrong. And it turns out there are many explanations for that flash crash of May 6, 2010. But one of the really compelling explanations for which there's a lot of support is that, you know, there was a sale that happened that was done by a set of algorithms, but then it created a domino effect where a bunch of these trading algorithms all started looking at each other and selling. And that's not the only example. There are many other examples of algorithms gone awry. There was the story a couple of years back based on an investigation done by ProPublica. They looked at algorithms used in courtrooms in the U.S. And what they found was that these algorithms that were used in courtrooms in Florida had a race bias. So two defendants with very similar backgrounds but different races, it was more likely to give a higher risk score to a black defendant than a white defendant. There was another example late last year of algorithms used in recruiting, and these algorithms had a gender bias. So they were less likely to invite a female applicant for a job interview, even if her qualifications were similar to the male applicant. And this is despite these algorithms being denied access to the problematic variables. So the algorithm that was making sentence decision or predicting the likelihood of a defendant reoffending did not have access to race. The recruiting algorithm did not have access to the gender of the applicant. And yet it figured out, you know, through other things like the name of the applicant and other kinds of signals, it managed to infer those things and ended up having these biases. And so I think this is a genuine risk that we face, that certain algorithms, if we don't have the right checks and balances, they could really create a lot of trouble.
And I think the issue is that we tend to think of algorithms and these sort of experiments as very objective.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, most people tend to think of machine decisions as being objective, number crunching, you make an objective decision. And, you know, all of these examples that I've just described suggest that they are prone to human biases, which of course begs the question, where do these biases come from? And when I narrate these stories, oftentimes people think, hey, is it being programmed in? Is an engineer putting in this bias? And that's almost never the case. No engineer is putting in a condition that says if gender is female, then don't invite this person for an interview. It's actually coming from a very interesting source. And as I was trying to explain the sources of algorithm biases and algorithm behavior, rogue behaviors, I realized that you could explain algorithm behavior in much the same ways as you can explain human behavior. So with human behavior, psychologists tend to talk about, you know, our behavior being driven by nature and nurture. Nature is our genetic code, what we inherit from our parents. Nurture is our environment, who we tend to hang out with, for example. And if you look at things like alcoholism, you know, they have a basis in nature, they have a basis in nurture as well. And I've realized algorithms are very similar. They have nature and nurture too. Nature is their code. It's not their genetic code, but it's the code that the engineer has given it, which specifies what the algorithm should do. And it's kind of like the genetic code that is dictating a lot of things for us as well. And nurture for algorithms is the data from which they learn. And much like we learn from our environment, modern algorithms learn from data. And so when we look at these problems, they could come from the code, what the engineer coded in, but they can also come from the data. And if we are not careful about what kind of data these algorithms are learning from, they can pick up lots of these kinds of problems as well.
It sounds just like the same way in which unconscious bias enters into it. It's a series of decisions over time that sort of add up to this unconscious bias. It's the same way with algorithms, because algorithms are simply a series of rules.
Yes, yes. You know, I think that analogy is very appropriate. It's the way unconscious biases come in, and it's over time, these small things we observe. We don't explicitly kind of say, okay, from now on, I'm going to, you know, let's say have these generalizations about gender or race, but it's small things that add up over time, and you build these unconscious biases. And it's the same with these algorithms in the sense that they're learning from this data. And I think what's interesting over here is how it's evolved. If we rewind back 20 years, algorithms used to be all nature and very little nurture. And what I mean by that is their behavior was dictated by the programmer who's coding in very precise sets of rules that they would follow. For example, if an engineer was trying to build an algorithm to diagnose diseases, 20 years back, that approach would have involved interviewing doctors and asking them, what are the rules you use to diagnose diseases? And the doctor might give us a set of rules. Hey, first I look at the, you know, I don't know, if that person has a cold, do they also have a fever? Do they have body ache? And based on the combination of symptoms, I explore viral versus bacterial sources and so on. And they would code these rules in. And it turns out these kinds of algorithms did reasonably well, but they were no match to humans. Because the problem is there's a lot of knowledge that people have that they cannot articulate or express. You know, if I were to ask you, you know, what are the rules for driving? You know, you can give me a bunch of rules, and I could use those rules and create software that can drive, but sure enough, that software is going to run into an accident within 10 or 15 minutes. Because, Rich, there's a lot of knowledge you have that you cannot express in the form of rules you use for driving. It's tacit knowledge. You use it, but you're not even aware that you're using it. And what's happened in recent years is engineers have realized that to build AI or artificial intelligence, instead of asking experts to give us all the rules, we can actually have systems learn the rules by just looking at data. So instead of interviewing doctors and asking them the rules, the modern approach is to give the algorithm data of, let's say, 1 million patients. What symptoms did they walk in with, and what was the final diagnosis given by the doctor? And the system analyzes the data and learns the patterns, you know, what symptoms predict what final diagnosis. Similarly, you wanted to drive a car, you give it data, meaning videos, of thousands of people driving. And it analyzes, the software analyzes the data and figures out the pattern, when to brake, when to change lanes, and so on. And so that's the world we are in today. And coming back to your point about, you know, these rules, and what it's learning, some of it is actually over time, much like, let's say, unconscious bias. It's essentially learning from the data. And if the data have biases, because humans ultimately have biases, these algorithms learn that. So if you give it a data set and say, learn who to invite for job interviews based on our data on who we hire, who we promote, if there is a gender bias in the organization and women are, let's say, less likely to be promoted, the algorithm is going to look at the data and say, well, it's the men who are getting promoted. So, you know, that's the rule it then learns as well.
My guest today is Kartik Hosanagar. He's a professor of technology and digital business, as well as in marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And his book is titled A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, How Algorithms Are Shaping Our Lives and How We Can Stay in Control. It's published by Viking. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. As an interviewer, I'm constantly doing internet research on guests. And what I find is, like, when I'm on a search engine, I'll see very relevant research results, but also I'll see outliers from something I did 2 weeks ago, from 3 weeks ago, that somehow found its way into this particular search. It usually strikes me as amusing, but how aware should we be of the fact that algorithms are constantly nudging us in a certain direction? I think that's the way to think of it, is they're nudging us in a direction.
Yeah, they're absolutely nudging us in various directions. And I'm going to say that for the most part, it's good. And if we had to look through 1 million pages to find the information we need, that would have consumed so much time.
Yes.
So the fact that Google's algorithm organizes these pages and says, this is the order in which you should look at it, and we then say, okay, we'll just look at the top five and we'll get done there, or maybe just the top result and we get done there, that saves us time. Netflix or Amazon says, hey, here's what you should be looking at. Again, those suggestions save us time. So there's a lot of value here. But if we become very passive about how we use technology, then the problem is that when we are being misled, we'll end up making wrong decisions. Today, you could go and ask a banker, you know, why did a certain loan get approved or disapproved? The answer might be, well, I just put the information in the software and it said reject, and that's all I can tell you, right? And that's a problem. And especially in settings where algorithms are making socially consequential decisions, like who gets a loan, you know, who gets a job, you know, how are sentencing decisions made? So there are settings in which the stakes are very high, and we cannot afford to be very passive about how we use technology. So I think it's important for us to become wise and knowledgeable, at least at a high level. We don't need to know all the ins and outs of these algorithms, but at a high level, we need to know how do these algorithms work, what data are they using, and how are they changing the decisions I'm making or that others are making about me. And just knowing that at the high level is helpful, because then you would know, you know, I applied for a job, but my application got rejected and the company used social media posts in addition to what I filled in my job application. Is that acceptable to me? Is that allowed? You know, so I think we need that high level of algorithm literacy. I would almost argue that basic algorithm literacy should be taught in schools, because this is so fundamental. It's going to drive all kinds of decisions around us. And, you know, that basic literacy is very important for us to make sure that we are in the end in control and not algorithms in control of us.
And it's going to be even more important as AI grows up, becomes more intelligent, and is used more in the formation of algorithms and how algorithms are applied. And I think you get at that in this book with you talk about an algorithmic bill of rights.
Yeah, so I was kind of thinking through, if algorithms have so much impact on decisions we make, and in many ways we are just getting started because AI is going to advance and it's going to make more and more decisions for us. It's going to drive cars. It's going to decide treatment options. It's going to do so many more things for us. So how do we provide some level of consumer protection, especially when these algorithms might be deployed by large technology companies, and sometimes some of the best performing algorithms today are black boxes, even for the engineers who created them. So even the engineers can't explain some of those decisions, and that's a problem. And so how do we provide consumers with protection? And so that led me to propose an algorithmic bill of rights, which is a basic set of consumer protections. And I have four main pillars in the algorithmic bill of rights. The first two are related to transparency. Actually, the reason I propose both of these pillars on transparency is that many times algorithms are making decisions for us. We don't even know an algorithm was used. We don't know what data was used by the algorithm. We don't know what are the factors that drove the decision. So these two pillars on transparency are just asking for, number one, transparency on data. Number two, explanations on what drove the decision.
And so most of that, may I interrupt and I say most of those are part of proprietary information by private companies, aren't they?
They are, you know, and we don't know what's going in there. And sometimes some of what is used is perhaps even inappropriate. Like I mentioned, the use of social media posts to make recruiting decisions. Is that appropriate? Maybe it is if you've got my consent. But, you know, some of our information is floating around. Companies are sharing information, and we don't even know that. So transparency is just asking for, let us know what are the sources of data. Now, I'm not saying it needs to be with every algorithmic decision, but it needs to be in socially important settings, like some of the ones we talked about. Similarly, explanations on decisions. If a credit application was rejected, just what were the most important factors that this algorithm tends to look at? You know, maybe the analysis will tell us, look, it's based on employment, education, income, and maybe that's okay. But then you might also find out through such a simple explanation that the algorithm tends to look quite carefully at your address or your zip code.
Yes.
And that might suggest it's a problem because that's correlated to your race, let's say.
Yes.
And so these two pillars on transparency are just trying to ensure that we have some control and knowledge over what's happening. And the third pillar I suggest is some level of consumer control. And I think that's important because that allows users to influence how algorithms affect their decisions. As an example, 2 years back, Facebook's newsfeed algorithm showed us what news posts we should look at. And, you know, we know that fake news stories were circulated. The algorithm failed to detect fake news stories. But interestingly, a lot of users did detect them. A lot of users did realize fake news is circulating in my newsfeed, but they had no way of informing the algorithm. Today, with two clicks, you can let the algorithm know that I think this content is offensive or I think this content is fake, and that allows the algorithm to take your feedback and improve over time. So users can actually have some control, or even to say, like we do in some ad networks today, where you can say, don't show me ads like this. You know, some basic user control is, I think, important, and we shouldn't eliminate the human in the loop.
Of course, you've also found examples of companies that, say, in making matches, say you want a certain set of characteristics, the company has learned algorithms that say, well, you say you want this, but you really want this.
Yes, that's really interesting because, yeah, with Match.com, one of their data scientists mentioned that people are so poor at specifying their preferences. You ask them, who do you want to date? And they give you a set of criteria. And then Match.com would show people a bunch of profiles that met the criteria. And users weren't interested in that. Instead, they were lurking in profiles of other people. And so Match.com said, okay, let me ignore what the user is saying he or she wants. Let me focus on what's the data telling me. Where are they spending their time?
Yeah.
And so they learned to ignore user preferences. And this is true in many other settings because it is a fact that we are very poor at saying what we want. But we do need some balance is what I feel. Completely ignoring user preferences could be a problem. And it has happened before. Facebook previously tried giving users more control over what they want in their newsfeed. But when they gave those controls to users, users actually changed their newsfeed in ways that actually reduced their engagement with Facebook. And so Facebook said, okay, let's get rid of these controls. And so I think this notion of control is a pretty tricky one. And my conclusion is maybe you don't have to give the user complete control, but make sure there is some way for the user to have some feedback to the algorithm. And that's important. And the last pillar in my Bill of Rights is not so much a right as it is a responsibility. I think all of this will work only if we take, as users, some responsibility here. Technology, in the end, can serve us only if we are not passive with it, if we actually attempt to understand, you know, what exactly are we using? How does this work? How is it changing decisions I'm making, or how is it changing decisions others are making for me or about me? And that allows us to then ask for what we want. For example, we're now seeing Facebook is changing its product, and it's saying we're going to support message encryption. We're going to have messages that don't live forever so that 10 years later, somebody can find a social media post you posted as a teenager. And so it's doing all this because users pushed back. And why did users push back? Because they eventually understood what is happening here and they said we want something else. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the power of our knowledge. I think having that knowledge allows us to ask for the right sets of things from the companies, but also vote for the right sets of representatives who are going to provide us protection from, you know, these technologies and do it in a way that does not curb innovation. So I think finding that middle ground is important, and that comes from us taking some responsibility and ownership. And so my fourth pillar is about users stepping up as well.
All right. Professor Hosanagar, thanks for joining us here on Studio Tulsa.
Rich, thanks so much for having me.
Kartik Hosanagar is a professor of technology and digital business, as well as a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. And he is the author of A Human's Guide to Machine Intelligence, How Algorithms Are Shaping Our Lives and How We Can Stay in Control. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.